Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to the 55th edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. We've got Valentine's Day sales on the way for you, another possible sporting goods bankruptcy, and Walmart actually getting into the sporting goods fray, as well as a REIT shedding light on increasing retail rents. But before we get to any of that, today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/retail. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. The story leading our podcast this week, though, comes from the shoe retail sector, and Payless Shoe Source, according to a report from Bloomberg, could be closing up to 1,000 stores as they endeavor to restructure their debt from its current creditors. This is a massive reduction in overall store footprint for Payless Shoe Source, which has moved increasingly online over the last few years. Leighton, let's talk a little bit about the history of this store.
So Payless was founded in Topeka, Kansas in 1956, and they're primarily known as a discount shoe retailer, which is what you prefaced with, and they now operate 4,496 locations globally. So they first started out here in the United States, but over the last three decades or so, they're going across the ocean and downward towards South America. And they're still headquartered in Topeka today, despite having grown so much. But as you mentioned, 1,000 stores of the 4,496 locations, that means that they're looking to close potentially over 20% of their total store count. They also operate a fully functional e-commerce site, which was started in 1999. The company has a long history of different ownership as well, several periods of being publicly traded and privately owned. Currently, they're privately owned. As of May 2012, they were bought by Wolverine Worldwide, Blum Capital, and Golden Gate Capital for $1.32 billion. So it was an actual partnership of several different private equity firms. Now, under falling sales and reduced margins, the company has a less amount of operating cash to pay on its $600 million outstanding debt load. The biggest chunk of this loan, again, according to Bloomberg, is a $520 million loan that comes due in 2021. So it's a matter of liquidity right now for Payless Shoe Source, and that they're not able to pay these debt payments on time, or they're having a little bit trouble paying the outstanding balance month to month. So the company has started consulting with Guggenheim Partners, which is really the management side of this operation, to try to renegotiate some deals, and Kirkland and Ellis LLP, which is the lawyer side of things. So they're trying to assist in finding the right strategy of negotiating a new financial structure for the company in order to pay this $520 million debt load. People close to the situation say that if the company cannot make a deal with its lenders, they will be forced to close a large part of the current store base. And that ties into how you introduced this story. They're looking at close to 1,000 stores, insiders are saying. They're weighing the option to try to settle this amount, this debt load, try to renegotiate before a potential bankruptcy. They can even do this by going to judges. You don't necessarily have to see a judge after a bankruptcy filing, but they are weighing their options currently, and we should know what direction they're going into in the next couple of months.
Now, this isn't the first time the company has decided to kind of adjust their brick and mortar setting. In fact, if you look back in 2004 as portion of a major restructuring, Payless announced that at the time it would close down their Parade chain and hundreds of Payless Shoe Source outlets. Now, after that point, they grew out their brick and mortar chain once again. But one thing that you touched on, Leighton, was the matter of liquidity. And this is something that we've discussed as far as shoe retailers in the past, in that inventory can be a fickle beast for a shoe retailer. When you look at Finish Line, almost exactly 1 year ago this month, they were suffering from low inventory levels. And when special releases came out, Finish Line found themselves hamstrung. They didn't have enough inventory on hand to cover the demand of those releases. Now, in certain other circumstances, we see for other shoe retailers that too much inventory can cause an issue because shoe sales can be very specialized, not only in terms of style, but also in terms of sizes. And over the last several years, when a number of companies are looking increasingly more towards the off-price space, that's something that Payless began to step away from beginning in 2004. And so although we can't get a very good look at their financials, the fact that they desire liquidity and the fact that they are a little bit financially hamstrung could well be fueled by increased inventory levels. And I know from the Payless shoe sources that I have visited over the last several months, they have extensive clearance sections. They have a hard time rotating shoes in and out. And this seems to be a problem more recently for Payless than it was, say, 5 to 10 years ago. Some could blame certainly the brick and mortar presence in an area in shoes where people are going increasingly online. But at the same time, their e-commerce site, I think, is probably the most functional part of their business. The bottom line, though, is the fact that they need some form of liquidity and they need it fairly fast. They started moving towards a superstore concept back in 2012. And I think when you're looking at other possible scapegoats for the lack of liquidity and the amount of debt that they have, it might be this superstore concept. Now, management has cited success with these larger format stores overseas, but here in the United States, it's been somewhat dubious as to the benefit they're getting from these larger superstores, the footprints of which mimic a shoe carnival, if you're familiar with that chain. In September of last year, so September of 2016, the company said that its customer base wanted more selection, and so that also drove their idea towards the superstores that they had. But again, when you get more money tied up in inventory because you feel like your customers want more selection, that can impact your liquidity. And when you're constantly tied up in things like inventory, purchasing and building out new real estate formats, new store formats, and making sure those are all stocked, those all take a toll on your cash flow as a retailer.
You mentioned some very excellent points, and some of the things really tie together quite well in that they are trying to have a larger store, the superstore concept. They've cited a lot of success, not only internationally, but here domestically. But here domestically, they are having those inventory problems that you had talked about. And I think those larger stores, even though that ties into how their consumer base wants a larger selection to choose from, they are a little bit more costly, not only on the inventory side, but on the overhead side as well. You're talking about lighting bills that are going to be more, and you're talking about less sales per square foot. That's just how it works. But when you have a larger amount of SKUs inside those stores, that's when you start to realize higher traffic levels into those individual outlets. But over the next 3 years, they said they will be trying to close 300 to 500 smaller outposts is what they called them. And this was from the statement CEO Paul Jones had made in September of last year that you had talked about. They also cited high rental costs as a largening burden on their business. And I think this really plays into the fact that these smaller outlets are in a lot of mall spaces that are seeing increasingly high rent despite stagnant traffic levels. So this is a headwind that the company has been facing. And they said that it's really forced them to look more at the individual store's profitability rather than overall market. So this makes sense in that if high rent rates are up in a particular area, even though traffic is really high and let's say an individual store is performing very well on the revenue side of things, it just may not work out as far as the cost-benefit analysis is concerned. They also mentioned that over the next 3 years is when they're going to be closing these smaller outposts because they don't want to break commercial leases and then have to pay those brokerage fees. So I think a lot of what management has to deal with here is just being very careful on the financial side of things. But overall, it is a mix of strategy. You see that e-commerce presence is quite strong, Trent. You alluded to that earlier. And this is something that CEO Paul Jones also said, and that their omnichannel infrastructure is not going to do. And he said that back in September as well. I go on Payless's e-commerce site here recently, and I see that they have done nothing to enhance any omnichannel capabilities, nothing as far as purchase online, pickup in store, or any of those types of things, even though he said that almost every IT capital project underway at Payless relates to some sort of capability that the project will unlock for us in terms of omnichannel. So I think in conclusion here, you're saying that the retailer is acknowledging all of their faults, but they are just not executing fast enough, and they have not properly allocated funds in the short term to really enhance their long-term strategy.
I think you touch on a very salient point in that you had mentioned how the 300 to 500 store closures they had ticketed in the announcement of September of last year had been ticketed for the next 3 years so that they aren't breaking those commercial leases. However, this new report suggests that the closures could be a little bit more frequent, up to 1,000 stores, and also a little bit more urgent. And when you get into those type of things, you get into, as you mentioned, breaking some of those leases, especially in shopping malls where, Leighton, you mentioned rents have been going up, but also those leases are among the most airtight in the retail world. So that poses a possible danger going forward for Payless. And then the other thing you touched on, I mentioned how their e-commerce site is pretty well functional. It is nice to browse through and it works very well, especially given how it's been around since 1999. They've retooled it multiple times. However, e-commerce does not equate to omnichannel. And when we talk about retailers offering omnichannel offerings, it is tying the e-commerce site into the store and the brick and mortar presence. And sometimes people will call e-commerce only retailers omnichannel retailers, but if they don't have an in-person presence, they're not really omnichannel. For Payless Shoe Source, it does seem as though there's a little bit of a cleft in between the two, and that might be something that management will want to address if they can create some of that cash flow through these impending closures.
Another retailer with liquidity problems, a report from Reuters has found that Gander Mountain is considering filing Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. This really indicates that sporting goods and outdoor retailers are still in flux for 2017. We spoke a lot about retailers going under in 2016, a lot of bankruptcies, a lot of transition in the industry overall. But for Gander Mountain's part, they were founded in 1960 and they're still headquartered in St. Paul, Minnesota. They were taken private via a partnership in 2010 by Gratco, a holding company controlled by Gander Mountain chairman and CEO David Pratt, and Holiday Station Stores, a gas station operator here in the United States. But this comes as another outdoor retailer, Eastern Outfitters, parent company of Eastern Mountain Sports and Bob Stores, again filed for bankruptcy on Monday of last week. And this ties nicely into what we were talking about all of last year, in that these sporting goods retailers and these outdoor retailers are facing emerging pressure from the e-commerce space and larger players that can really utilize economies of scale. As you may remember, as a listener of this podcast, they used to be Vestas Retail Group, a subsidiary of private equity firm Versa Capital, but changed their name after last year's bankruptcy and the closing of all Sports Chalet locations, primarily on the West Coast. But Eastern Mountain had closed 8 stores in the restructuring, and Bob Stores had closed 1. So this also comes as the U.S. Federal Trade Commission has demanded additional information on the merger deal between Cabela's and rival Bass Pro Shops. The deal had been delayed with no given time frame here in the last month or so. In October of last year, a $5.5 billion deal that we had announced here on the podcast would mean that Bass Pro would purchase Cabela stock for about $65.50 per share in an all-cash deal. However, this increased scrutiny in this sector, in the litany of bankruptcies and downsizing efforts that's been happening in the outdoor retail segment, it may be harder for a smaller operator like Gander Mountain and others to compete with larger firms. And really, this relates back to the U.S. Federal Trade Commission looking at that Cabela's and Bass Pro Shops merger deal. They're maybe looking at the industry overall, saying that we don't want to push out these smaller operators in Gander Mountain that have less than 200 locations.
I think it does show some danger signs regarding Cabela's and Bass Pro Shops. We've seen in other retail mergers how tight the FTC has been of late. Of course, Staples and Office Depot was much ballyhooed after their merger fell through last year. And now we have Rite Aid and Walgreens. That deal just keeps getting postponed and postponed. And I think if you are Cabela's or Bass Pro, more importantly, Bass Pro, who is kind of proposed this deal to take over Cabela's, you are very concerned as you see this potential bankruptcy from Gander Mountain. Now, it should be said that they have not yet filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and Gander Mountain is a private company, so we don't have quite as many financials from them. But it does give you cause for concern as to whether this deal will go through or not. Gander Mountain, in terms of square footage, most of their stores are going to be smaller square footage than the Cabela's or Bass Pro Shops. They're kind of a Cabela's or Bass Pro Shops Junior. They operate in a similar square footage in most of their stores as another store that we talked about here on the podcast in Sportsman's Warehouse, who is beginning to grow throughout the West and Midwestern United States. We talked about them having locations as far east as Iowa, and maybe they're licking their chops at the potential of a Gander Mountain bankruptcy or at the potential of Gander Mountain having to liquidate some of their stores. Gander Mountain, this might be a circumstance where they've grown out their store footprint too quickly, or at least more quickly than the market could hold. They grew out their store count by 31% over the last 5 years. So they saw some success or perhaps some writing on the wall as to a runway to future success through these new locations. At the same time, we've talked about sporting goods bankruptcies pretty frequently, but there are a few providers that are having success in this space. We talk about Dick's same store sales going up. We've talked about Academy before on the podcast. Obviously, Bass Pro isn't necessarily hurting for money, even though Cabela's has struggled off and on for the last few years. We've also discussed the fact that Sportsman's Warehouse is beginning to grow. REI is having great success in their brick and mortar locations and also online. And we'll talk about this retailer in the next segment, but Moose Jaw, which is a Michigan-based outdoor retailer, they're beginning to build out their brick and mortar format as well. So there are businesses that can be successful in this area. It's not a matter of all sporting goods companies going bankrupt because business is being pushed online, but rather this is a circumstance where, as far as this operator is concerned, Gander Mountain, I think it's pretty clear to see that they used up a lot of money, took out a lot of debt in trying to expand their store base. And we see this oftentimes from a number of retailers who either grow too quickly by acquisition or grow too quickly by internal expansion. They end up having to declare bankruptcy. Maybe they restructure their debt, or maybe they get bought out by another firm, as was the case with Hagen Grocery Stores last year when a similar thing took place.
You mentioned a lot of good points here, Trent, and that they have really grown a lot over the past few years. You had cited 31% growth in the last 5 years, and that equates to 50 locations in the last 5 years. And so I think if you look at where they're opening these locations, it's a bit of cause of concern as well. When you look at that regional competition and that overall national competition, where they're entering in the market is right in the Midwest. You had mentioned Dick's, Academy Sports, and Moose Jaw. Those are all retailers that have expanded quite fast here in the Midwest. So while there is an overall longer runway for these types of retailers, the competition is heightened a little bit. And even though they are receiving competition from multiple sources, their niche is primarily fishing, camping, and hunting gear. So they don't compete necessarily directly with the likes of Dick's or Academy Sports that do focus somewhat on sporting activities in other areas. But the variability in store format is a cause of concern for me. You had mentioned that it's a little bit smaller than those larger operators, but overall, if you see the range, it's quite large, between 50,000 square feet, which is a little smaller, to over 120,000 square feet. And that's because they're known for their large firearm selection, but they also have indoor gun ranges at some of their locations. So you see this variability in store footprint makes it harder for standardization. And this is important at the corporate level because you want to know how much sales per square foot are brought in from each particular location. And then also, as far as store merchandising is concerned, at the location level, you're looking at corporate planograms, seasonal outlays, etc. And these are things that all stores use on a day-to-day basis to function. And I think Target is a really good example of this, in that most of their stores are cookie cutter. Their corporate planograms are pretty much set up the exact same way depending on the store square footage. But you see a little bit of variability with some seasonal outlets. But if you relate this back to Gander Mountain's variability in square footage, I think that's an area where they may be paying a little bit more for some locations where they're not utilizing the square footage how they could be. So obviously they are under pressure as far as rental rates are concerned. That's something we talked about with Payless. So as we talk about finances, it all ties back in to the potential bankruptcy. The company has a $30 million loan and revolving credit lines for about $25 million and $500 million. Again, this is according to Thomson Reuters data, but it is not clear how much money in the credit lines Gander Mountain has yet to draw on right now or has drawn down to date. But Gander Mountain is working with a financial advisory firm, Lighthouse Management Corporation, and Frederickson and Byron PA on the law side to really prepare and file for bankruptcy if they need to. And this is something that relates back to the other story we were talking about previously, and that really consulting with the management and law firm side of things helps to understand where you are in the process and if truly Chapter 11 bankruptcy is going to be inevitable.
One final note about Gander Mountain is when you look at this from a historical perspective, they previously sought bankruptcy protections back in the 1990s. They've also been tied up with several lawsuits with Cabela's for multiple different reasons. So this isn't the first time that Gander Mountain has at least kicked the tires on bankruptcy protection. Well, from a struggling sporting goods retailer to one that has grown by leaps and bounds, we go to Moose Jaw, where Walmart has purchased Moose Jaw for $51 million. Now, Moose Jaw is a Michigan-based outdoor retailer. Their predominant presence is online, though they do have brick-and-mortar locations, and they've built out their brick-and-mortar presence throughout the U.S. They were founded back in 1992 by Robert Wolf and David Jaffe. Today, they have around 350 employees. And of course, the first concern usually when you talk about a buyout like this is what will happen to the employees? How will Walmart integrate Moose Jaw into their other offerings? And in this case, it appears as though Moose Jaw will be independently run, just owned now by Walmart. So the 350 employees are said to stay with the company. This is similar to Walmart's approach with not only Jet.com, which was an acquisition they made last year, but also ShoeBuy, who they purchased just last month. So $51 million for Moose Jaw. We look at why Walmart might have done this. When you see Moose Jaw, you see a retailer that has strong connections with multiple different companies that are big names in the outdoors wear industry, including Patagonia, The North Face, Marmot, among others. Now, you might wonder why Walmart would be going through a third party, in this case Moose Jaw, to connect with these companies, but it is interesting that Moose Jaw is one of the stronger retailers for these different brands, not only online, but in their 11 brick-and-mortar locations, and perhaps Walmart sees a way to tap into this potential and to tap into the connection with MooseJaw.com or their actual brick-and-mortar stores. Moose Jaw's CEO told the Detroit Free Press, his name is Ian Comerford, he said that, and I quote, "From the customer's perspective, they won't really see much change in MooseJaw.com or the stores. They're going to continue," he says, "to be an outdoor specialty retailer of premium brands." You'll have the same Moose Jaw voice and the same Moose Jaw madness, and they say that will be very prevalent. Now, I'm not sure about madness, but one of the interesting things regarding Moose Jaw is how well they run their social media and e-commerce presence. It's almost like they're in on a joke. When you read some of the text that is on their website or some of their product descriptions, really, they have a creative way and honestly a very authentic way of marketing themselves.
And when you look at that and other aspects of this deal, both companies certainly look to benefit from coming together. And I think from the Walmart side of things, they're looking to take advantage of that social media presence. The Moose Jaw madness relates to their social media and that they hashtag that quite often with their bold media campaigns. But they also have a strong e-commerce site, which you had mentioned before. It's an estimated 85% of Moose Jaw's total sales that are coming from the online space. So Walmart is seeing an operation that has these brick and mortar stores. The brick and mortar stores do very well in the Midwest, but they're seeing an operation that has excelled more so in the online space. And this ties perfectly into the Jet.com acquisition that they had last year for $3.3 $1.2 billion. So I think Moose Jaw has a lot to offer here. You had mentioned the strong apparel brands that they offer their customers, but overall, it's the social media and the adaptation of e-commerce that they have that they're really recognized for. And Moose Jaw has been recognized as a leader in online marketing by the New York Times, even, as well as about five other retail journals. So a lot going on with Moose Jaw. It appears as though management is going to stay in place, as well as the 350 hourly employees. They're all going to be staying with the company. And so really, you have a company that's going to be operating a little independently, but they're going to get the buying power too from Walmart. So I said both of these companies are looking to benefit, but Walmart's going to come in with a large amount of buying power from their headquarters, and they're going to be able to potentially get some better deals than Moose Jaw currently has out their retail stores. So I think this is going to be a great partnership for both of them going forward. I am just curious to see if they're going to be utilizing the executives at the very highest level from Moose Jaw and integrating them into the executive ranks there at Walmart, as you saw with Jet.com. You see a lot of transitions over the last 3 to 4 months, in particular in the online sector from Jet.com.
You know, I have to say, at least from this deal, you certainly hope that Walmart won't meddle too much in the dealings of Moose Jaw. As you click around on their website, I mentioned, and Leighton, you mentioned how well they've been received in terms of marketing, and you hope Walmart just leaves that aspect of it well enough alone. I think when you look at this deal, not only does it give Walmart some connections with these major outdoor brands that we've talked about, but also it gives them the option to tap into possible Moose Jaw profitability. Now, they aren't a publicly traded company, or at least they weren't until being bought out by Walmart, but we can assume that Walmart making this deal sees some sort of runway to profitability. If you look at the company timeline on their website, it really speaks to the type of voice that they use in putting together their website. Much of their website is written, or at least the website copy is written, as though some one person is in charge of their website, and they interject personal notes. For example, if you go to the timeline of the company growth on their website, and I'll quote here, 1992, Moose Jaw opens in Kego Harbor, Michigan. My mom got a new Mountaineer. My girlfriend cheated on me, but the boy was super handsome, so you really can't blame her. So that's the type of understated humor that they're using in trying to sell many of their products as well. And it works very well with their target market, which is mostly Generation X and Millennials, who are purchasing this type of outdoors gear from Moose Jaw. Looking forward to how Walmart and Moose Jaw are going to create these synergies, or if Walmart is simply just going to use Moose Jaw as a profit driver and potentially watch as Moose Jaw grows out their brick and mortar presence further.
One thing is clear, and that Walmart for sure has enough cash to supply this deal. $51 million is really a drop in the bucket when you look at how Walmart is still very profitable as a whole. And they're looking to enhance their core business. So I am curious to see if this is just the start of certain acquisitions for Walmart for 2017. But I would like to think that the real mission here is to maintain market share in their general merchandise segment through just a better overall e-commerce and omni-channel capability. And I think they're on the right track here with this acquisition from Moose Jaw.
And we shouldn't forget either that Walmart is one of the leading sporting goods retailers in the entirety of the United States. They're always among the top in terms of gun retailers in the U.S., as well as some of the outdoors retailers in the U.S., simply because of their store count. And, you know, we talk about Kroger building through acquisition all the time as almost the example we use of a company building out through acquisition. Well, Walmart really giving them a run for their money over the last 12 months. For you, the listeners of the Retail Focus podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. I know, Leighton, you've been engrossed in an audiobook yourself.
Yeah, I've been listening to Commercial Real Estate Investing, The Ultimate Beginner's Guide to Learn How to Invest in Commercial Real Estate and Build Your Real Estate Empire. And this is by Mark Thomas. It's about a 55-minute audiobook, but I just haven't found the time to finish it. It discusses even the retail dynamics of shopping centers. So normally $3.95, this can be your free book with the 30-day trial membership only at audibletrial.com/retail.
Again, that's audibletrial.com/retail for your free audiobook. It's funny, Leighton, you talk about listening to an audiobook about commercial real estate investing, and honestly, that's a lot of what our next story is about, as we look at Retail Properties of America. They released their fourth quarter earnings and full year fiscal 2016 results on Tuesday of this week. Now, this is a different business than we typically talk about on the Retail Focus podcast, because we're not talking about a product line. We're not talking about a specific retailer or a specific retail space. But what we are talking about is a real estate investment trust. Retail Properties of America specializes in mid to high end shopping centers. And one of the unique things about this REIT, or real estate investment trust, is that they operate entirely in the United States. They own 156 retail operating properties. And I think by looking at the numbers that they released this week, we get a very good feel for how retail rents are going and whether or not their space is filled.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a very interesting earnings call to mull through, because this isn't a type of segment we cover often, but we do talk about the dynamics of higher rents. We talked about it here with the bankruptcy proceedings that could be potentially happening with Gander Mountain and the Payless Shoe Source woes, citing higher rents within malls and other smaller shopping centers. So you see that 95% of their commercial property holdings for Retail Properties of America remain in the retail space. The remaining is for office use, but 25.8 million square feet in total space is what they own at the end of last year's calendar year. So you're saying that the company reported 25 cents per share on earnings for the quarter, beating a consensus estimate by 1 cent. Retail Properties of America also had a net margin of 25.7% and a return on equity of 7%. The numbers I really wanted to focus on, how this pertains to retail, is the net operating income, or moreover, the revenue that these retail outlets get minus all operating expenses such as insurance, taxes, and general administrative expenses. They had a 1.9 increase in same-store net operating income for the period. Total same-store portfolio percent leased, including leases signed but not commenced, came in at 95.7%. So this basically means that all the vacancy was only about 4% in total by the end of December 31st, 2016. This was up 30 basis points from 95.4% in September of 2016. But you look at their overall portfolio, their retail portfolio percent leased, including leases signed but not commenced, up to 95%. So again, we're looking at about a 5% vacancy level that is very good in this industry. Retail portfolio average base rent per occupied square foot came in at $17.11. This was up 5.2% from $16.27 per annualized base rent in December of last year. So you're looking at these numbers and you're really wondering what they're all about. If you're looking at the number, the price per square foot, the annualized price per square foot, that's how much the retailers within the spaces are paying per square foot on an annualized basis. So you're seeing this has increased quite substantially over inflation, almost doubled inflation last year, 5.2%. So when retailers such as Payless are complaining about increased rents, this is where it's coming for. These REITs are requiring a higher level of return on their investment. Therefore, they need a better net income. And how you do that is to boost the overall rent rate.
REITs, on the stock market at least, are well known for offering high dividends to their investors, and that's one of the reasons why you see this pressure on REITs to increase the amount that they are getting from their lessees. But as kind of a summary to all the numbers you gave, their total portfolio percent leased went up, their retail portfolio percent leased went up, and the rent went up. So we hear so much, and this is why we're kind of bearish on the idea that retail, especially in the brick and mortar space, is shrinking back, that retail is dying, because we see REITs that specialize in retail oftentimes seeing massive success, and they're able to get away with charging larger amounts per square foot. When you see a vacancy rate at about 4.3%, yet annualized base rent is going up about 5%, as you mentioned, Leighton, about twice what inflation is. That suggests to me that the brick and mortar retail industry, at least as far as the chase for real estate is concerned, is pretty healthy. Now, whether or not those stores in those spaces see a ton of success, it's kind of up to the individual store, but we know that there is almost more demand than at any point over the last 12 months currently for empty real estate spaces, which kind of runs contrary to a lot of what you would read in mainstream news outlets that talk a lot about mall rents going up and malls emptying out, malls becoming ghost towns, and so forth. I wanted to look at the individual strategy of Retail Properties of America. Now, this is a real estate investment trust in the retail area that does target high income, densely populated areas typically. They don't have a whole lot of rural offerings. The idea there is to keep rents high. They want vacancies to be kept to a minimum because vacancies are the type of thing in retail real estate that can snowball on you. For instance, their most recent retail center acquisitions have very strong demographic profiles when you're looking at well-to-do areas with dense population. Average household income of these acquisitions or nearby these acquisitions come in at $109,000, and the weighted average population of 84,000 within a 3-mile radius, which is once again very significant. You're looking at densely populated urban or suburban areas here. And Leighton, what I was curious about, they mention a lot of other numbers in this particular release and in this earnings statement and their year-end earnings as well that I think not only a lot of listeners to the podcast, but people including myself that aren't really familiar with the world of real estate in terms of retail may not know, but they mention terms like dispositions and leasing spreads throughout these releases. Do you mind explaining to our listeners what those are?
Yeah, so I'll first start by explaining comparable cash leasing spreads. They had reported they had a 27.4% increase on new leases and 4.5% on renewal leases for a blended spread of 6.8%. So what is that? A lease spread is simply the amount which the lease payments exceed the mortgage payments. So as with other businesses, as with other firms in this arena, the company has to finance their operations. They have to finance the procurement of the buildings themselves. And so this is basically representing the percent difference from the lease rate from the mortgage rate. So you're saying that they're having to pay monthly payments like you would on a conventional home loan, for instance. And so this is really the positive cash spread that you're viewing from these investments. And so anytime it exceeds one, you're saying that this is obviously a positive return on investment. But here you're saying positive comparable cash leasing spreads of, again, 27.4% on new leases. This means that they're actually acquiring better leases overall, a better rate of return overall on new leases than they were prior. You're saying that, again, the blended spread is 6.8. So these new leasing spreads are actually higher than their total average. You had also mentioned, Trent, the dispositions for the company. You had mentioned and outlined very well the strategy of this company in particular, how they're looking at high income areas, densely populated areas, and they keep in line this strategy every quarter. So every quarter they analyze their portfolio of holdings throughout the United States. And this last year in 2016, the company completed $543 million in what they called dispositions, or basically selling assets that were non-target multi-tenant retail assets. So essentially these retail assets were no longer fitting in their particular demographic that they like to target. And they had sales of 10 of these in 2016 for a total of $386.6 million. So you're seeing how this all really works into their strategy overall of expanding their net operating income. They are looking at these high income areas, really seeing that the return on equity is higher. So these buildings are able to request a little bit more rent. And obviously, this is an economic situation where because of the high demand in these areas, they're able to keep prices high. And their overarching goals, they're targeting 2 to 3% growth in net operating income in 2017 as a whole.
And if you are interested in the world of retail-centric REITs, you look at other companies like Kimco Corporation, for example, the Simon Property Group, and of course, Seritage Growth Properties, which is the Sears spinoff REIT that we talk about. All of them have significant holdings in retail, and there's scores of others, but I feel like the REIT financials almost give us a better barometer of what retailers are doing as a whole than individual companies' financials do, because again, they would include things like mom and pop businesses and smaller privately held firms, which we don't often get around to discussing in terms of whether their sales go up or down during a given year.
For the last story of the Retail Focus podcast, in the lead up to Valentine's Day, the National Retail Federation said U.S. consumers were projected to spend less on Valentine's Day than the last 2 years. Valentine's Day spending was estimated to reach $18.2 billion this year. We might think that's a very large number. However, when you compare that to last year, it's 7.6% less. Last year, Valentine's Day spending hit a record $19.7 billion. It's also less than the year prior, 2015. Spending in the United States reached $18.9 billion. And these figures from the National Retail Federation are fairly accurate in that before the official figures came out last year, they had already predicted $19.7 billion. So they hit it spot on as opposed to the other figures that we've quoted on this podcast, such as Halloween sales. Overall, though, they are higher than 2014 spending, where you saw $17.4 billion in Valentine's Day sales. Some speculate the number could come in slightly higher than anticipated because it fell on a Tuesday this year. This was something that we had talked about with 1-800-Flowers, and that their managers were very bullish on the Tuesday. They were saying that sales are going to be higher than last year. Last year, Valentine's Day fell on a Sunday, and the year before that, a Saturday. Me personally, I would think that a Saturday would be very good for the industry in that you have a lot of people dining out. You have a lot more traffic overall in the mall space. Sunday, not so much. You see a lot of retailers closing down, specialty retailers not doing as much business on a Sunday. So I am curious to see what the official figure comes out for this year.
It is interesting, and I think a lot of it is very day-centric because, as you mentioned, sometimes you don't get the traffic out at places on, especially restaurants and that type of thing, when it is on a weeknight. And, of course, you've got to worry, at least in the case of many couples, about going to work the next day and all of that. What I'll be most anxious to see about as we begin to cover kind of the aftermath of Valentine's Day are some of those specialty retailers that have struggled of late. We talk about 1-800-Flowers.com being one example of those. I'll be anxious to see how they fared in particular this Valentine's Day. But I did hear from a few flower shops that were around where I live. They actually had a surfeit of inventory after everything had settled down post Valentine's Day. So, of course, that's not a positive sign as far as flower retailers are concerned. I think perhaps the most interesting numbers to me, though, come from the breakdowns of what we spend money on here in the United States during Valentine's Day. The grand majority of money goes towards things like flowers and gifts, as well as sweets. In fact, $1.7 billion on sweets and sugary goods alone. Dinners out account for a healthy chunk of this. You're looking at about $4.5 billion in dining out, and then perhaps $4.3 billion in jewelry. At least that's the estimated number. So people getting out, buying larger gifts or larger dollar gifts, larger ticket gifts for their significant others during Valentine's Day. But I think it's even more interesting, you know, there's been a lot of cynicism recently. Well, not recently. It's always more or less been there via Valentine's Day. But you see a lot of social media cynicism regarding Valentine's Day. But young adults, adults under 35 years old, according to a survey by Discover, were found to spend an average of $185, which is about $40 more than survey respondents overall. So once you get above the age of 35, you're not maybe spending quite as much on Valentine's Day. They attributed this to a number of different factors. One is because you're in a new relationship phase. When you are under 35, you're more likely to be in that category. story, and so there is more pressure to splurge there on Valentine's Day. And also, there might be some dovetailing there between some larger expenditures, for example, things like engagement rings for those proposing to their significant others during Valentine's Day. But I found that the most interesting, considering you're seeing a lot of millennials, which would be in that under 35 group, begin to rebel against Valentine's Day and at least claim that they don't put too much quarter into it.
You do see increased cynicism throughout social media. A lot of people saying that this is just a consumer holiday. This isn't a normal traditional religious holiday, and that this is primarily driven by retailers who just want to make a dollar. But you see the number of people who celebrate Valentine's Day. That number's been falling since 2007. Only 54% celebrate the holiday, fewer than the 54.8% who celebrated in 2016. So you're saying that a decline in overall participation is probably hindering the sales numbers that we're talking about. And if you break down into individual spending, you're saying that people do spend less than they did overall in 2015 and 2016, or at least that is projected. So a lot of involved numbers here with Valentine's Day spending. What I found interesting relates back to what you were talking about with what people spent the most on. And I have a friend who lives out in California, and she had said that she had received a Valentine's Day present. And I had asked what it was, and she said candy, a greeting card, and flowers. And that fits right in to the metrics that you were listing off, Trent, seeing that candy represents about 50% of average Valentine's Day sales. And if you look at a broader picture of what this consumer spending overall means for the economy, consumer spending drives nearly 70% of the nation's GDP. So this is sort of a bellwether holiday. Analysts are going to be looking to see if these projections come in line with what is reality.
And there are some businesses that won't be impacted quite as much, but even you look at businesses like Walmart, Target, and Kroger, they figure to be impacted slightly by Valentine's Day, as well as drugstore chains. Oftentimes you'll see Walgreens or CVS make passing references to Valentine's Day as far as their front of store sales, because they are go-tos for last minute cards or last minute chocolates, that type of thing. You know, other breakdowns that I found interesting just as we wrap up this story, we talk about the breakdown of people that are younger traditionally spending more than people that are older. Men spend nearly twice as much as women, $196 per male versus about $99 per female. That is according to the National Retail Federation's survey this year. And then 90% of people responding to this survey were planning on buying Valentine's Day gifts for their significant others. So despite the fact that only about 54% technically celebrate the holiday, still 90% buy gifts for their significant others. And obviously you have in that overall sample size a lot of people that perhaps are unattached or considered single that aren't celebrating the holiday. But I've got to be honest, Leighton, I'm in the 10% that didn't buy Valentine's Day gifts for their significant others. My significant other and I have an agreement. We've never bought each other a Valentine's Day gift during the duration of our relationship. So unfortunately for a lot of retailers, we might be taking a little bit of that chunk out of the consumer spending that drives the 70% of GDP in the U.S.
Yeah, I'm sure the gross domestic product won't miss your little $12 that you are most likely going to spend on your wife.
You know me well, Leighton. I tend to be a pretty frugal individual. So $12, that's probably about right in the case of Valentine's Day if I were indeed spending nothing.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the point on the Retail Focus podcast where each Leighton and I are looking ahead to one particular story, and we'll start with Leighton.
So this actually relates to something that you had talked about briefly during this podcast, and that is Walgreens and their potential merger with Rite Aid, or their acquisition, I should say. Walgreens Boots Alliance announced they're losing their chief merchandising and marketing officer, Linda Filler, who is a Walgreens president of retail products and chief merchandising marketing officer since about January of 2015. She's departing from the role. And this is interesting because it's caused a lot of speculation in and around the industry saying that, is this a sign of bad things to come for the company? We've seen that Rite Aid is trying to divest a very large number of their locations in order to get this deal finalized and to get federal approval. But you're seeing that an executive stepping down, that's not a good message the company is sending out. And from a PR perspective, I think they're trying to put out fires right now. And so I am curious to see who fills the spot here left open by Linda Filler, and if there are any implications that are being implied here by this transition.
Well, for those that follow retail on a regular basis, you'd know that the off-price segment had a lot of success during calendar year 2016. Well, coming up next week, the story I'm looking ahead to is the TJX earnings release that's scheduled to come out before the market begins on February 22nd, which would be a Wednesday. And keep in mind, Ross Stores will release earnings about 6 days after that on February 28th. Now, we saw a little bit of softness with Tuesday morning as they released earnings earlier this month. Not sure if that'll carry over to TJX and Ross, considering TJX and Ross had been outperforming Tuesday morning for the better part of the last few years in terms of whether or not they beat their analyst expectations. But I'm also intrigued regarding TJX's earnings because I would like to see what progress they've made with Sierra Trading Company. We talked at the beginning of this show about outdoors retailers and retailers that market towards those that are hunting, fishing, that spend a lot of time outside. And we also talked about retailers that are having success in that industry. Well, Sierra has grown out being one of the few off-price outdoors retailers that exist in the marketplace. And while they haven't added necessarily to their store base, they have added in terms of same-store sales. And we'll get a better idea, as it is a TJX brand, of how Sierra Trading Company is doing when that release comes out on Wednesday the 22nd. Well, that'll do it for us on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton Kling, I'm Trent Kling. Again, you can check us out on the Food Focus Podcast if you are so inclined, as well as on Twitter at Retail Podcast, where Leighton tweets out the retail news in between podcasts for all in the Twitterverse. A quick reminder to download your free audiobook courtesy of the Retail Focus Podcast today. Go to audibletrial.com/retail. Again, that's audibletrial.com/retail for your free audiobook courtesy Audible, the sponsor of today's episode. For Leighton, I'm Trent, saying so long until the next Retail Focus Podcast.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.